Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we take a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. Now, as we face into a new year and a new decade, we're going to take a special focus today on some of the significant, or some would say radical, proposals that are emerging in terms of our economic structures and our political systems and priorities. We're going to start with Martin Sanbu. He's the European economics commentator with the Financial Times and author of The Economics of Belonging, a radical plan to win back the left behind and achieve prosperity for all. Martin, you're very welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Very interesting book, Martin, about, I suppose, your view of what has caused a lot of the trends that have led to the growth of populist movements across Europe and in North America. And we'll discuss that later and as significantly some of your proposed solutions. But first, bring us back to when you think this movement first started happening and the fact that you believe it wasn't principally due to cultural changes, but pure economics.
Yes. Now, I wrote this book, like many others, in kind of shock and reaction to the big political disruptions in 2016, the Brexit referendum in the UK, the Trump election in the US, and trying to think hard about what had caused that, what had caused this backlash against the sort of standard Western liberal order that we had largely enjoyed since the end of the Second World War. And the more I looked at it, the more I saw that this had been in the making for a long time and it had deep economic causes. So what I call the economy of belonging is the sort of economy that to some extent we saw, or at least saw a movement towards in the three decades after the war, where in pretty much every Western country, you had this process of convergence, people's incomes becoming more equal, people's wealth levels becoming more equal, and very significantly, poorer places catching up with richer places within pretty much every Western country. And all of that sort of stopped, either stagnated or went into reverse around 1980 everywhere. It's really striking to see that these same dynamics happened everywhere. And really, that is what I call the end of economic belonging. And once you start looking at the politics of many countries, that is the reaction to that, that you see the start of the early populist anti-liberal movements. So the stuff that happened in 2016, the very disruptive politics of turmoil and polarization that we are suffering today, has very deep roots. One important point I try to make is that there are economic causes. There are people who are rightly angry at having been left behind by economic changes. But what they're wrong about is to blame globalization for it. So the populist movements they vote for say, look, we need to close the borders, we need to throw out the elites, and then everything will be good again, you know, make America great again, take back control, all these slogans. That, I think, is wrong. And it's up to people who support what was good about the Western liberal order to try to find better economic policies that can actually fix the real problems.
And you believe that this key economic shift that happened towards the late 70s, early 1980s, was principally a move from large factory-based industrial production, a largely male culture, a culture that didn't require too much formal education, to a more technological world?
That's the biggest part of it. And of course, this is what people complain about, also those who are part of this backlash. You know, the jobs went away. They tend to say the jobs went to China or wherever. But actually what happened was technological change. You simply don't need as many hands to produce the same amount of goods anymore. So the industrial jobs disappeared because we don't need as many industrial workers anymore. But what people don't seem to realize often is that Western countries, to a large extent, produce more industrial goods than ever. It's certainly sort of near record highs, even though it goes down in recessions and so on. But we produce much more industrial output, even in the richest countries, than we did in 1980. But we need many fewer people for it. So the jobs disappeared. They were always going to disappear because you get robots, you get automation, you get better machines, you get better production processes. So you just economize on labor. That's a natural development in modern economies. And we notice it most with industrial jobs. But of course, you've had the same thing with computerization getting rid of a lot of clerical jobs, the internet getting rid of, threatening at least, a lot of retail jobs. And who knows if artificial intelligence will get rid of, you know, driving jobs, for example, lorry drivers and so on, still a big source of employment. So this is a general pattern. But what was special in what happened sort of around 1980, when industrial employment peaked in pretty much all Western countries, is that the old industrial economy, it just tended to favor a certain group of people more than what came after. What came after was more knowledge-intensive services. And they're good for people with higher education, with better cognitive skills, people in cities, because these services thrive in the biggest cities. People are willing to move to the cities. Whereas the old economy kind of worked for smaller towns. It worked for people with less formal education. It often worked for men. And that's largely the group that's been left behind, and that supports these movements.
And as you say, sure, it was that key economic shift as well that began to cause disparities across regions as well as cohorts of workers, because of the greater propensity for technology-based jobs and education to be focused in large cities.
That's right. Think about the optimal scale of a factory. You know, it can kind of fit a mid-sized town. It can be spread across the territory. So kind of technologically, it's more territorially distributed than these very high value, high tech services you see today. You know, finance, tech development, that sort of services where the big value creation is today. But there's another element. The industrial economy was also good for building the institutions that created redistribution. Unions worked very well in industry, and they haven't managed to keep up in other sectors. So all of these things kind of were going to happen because technology develops. And the big question is, how did countries and governments respond? Some did better than others, but everyone's faced the same sort of shift. But in all of this, globalization is actually a minor. It's more of a bit player.
Well, just on that point, and in terms of the policy response, you're pretty acerbic, you're pretty sharp on Western policymakers generally, politicians generally. You accuse them of a learned helplessness, that they almost looked to globalization as a scapegoat, whereas in your view, as you've pointed out, that wasn't the fundamental issue at all.
Yes, I in the book, I draw this comparison with the 1930s and Roosevelt's New Deal. It's a comparison that's become popular recently, at least in the UK. But what's key about Roosevelt is just how radical he was. He changed so much. And you've had nothing similar in any Western country after, for example, the global financial crisis, which you think would have really shifted things and made people think about how to reform the system fundamentally. So compared to the scale of the challenge, policymakers have been rather timid, I think. And I say that even though we know that central banks have done things they've never done before and so on. But still, compared to the scale of the challenge, they were timid. Now, why were they timid? In my view, it's very often because they thought they were doing all they could, and that was kind of as far as they could go. And that's what I mean by learned helplessness. There was a perception that they were doing a lot, maybe doing all they could, everything they could, the best they could. That was wrong, but I think there was a role of ideas here. People really believed, you know, this is what we can do.
Our guest here on News Talk is Martin Sanbu, and we're talking to him about his latest book, The Economics of Belonging. Coming right up to date, Martin, and looking to solutions, and you helpfully propose many. But in the broader sense, you look to the Nordic countries in Europe as a model, not a perfect model, but a model for how liberal democracies might get themselves out of this populist threat. But before we tease that out, I mean, haven't some of the Scandinavian countries been as threatened by the rise of populism as any others?
No, they have indeed. And I do spend some time talking about Sweden in the book, which was maybe the ideal or the idealized social democracy for many. Actually, it turns out Sweden itself has changed significantly in terms of policies over the last 20 years, and people haven't quite kept up with that. And again, you see the rise of the Sweden Democrats, the Swedish far-right populist movement. It's very much concentrated in the same group of people in regions and in industries who have suffered from economic and policy change. But the point about the Nordics is, you know, I think on the whole, they've navigated these technological changes better than most other countries. Not perfectly. They have the same challenges. They are struggling to keep what's good about their models while adapting to new situations. But of course, I'm not saying that we should all copy the Nordics. It's more we should try to understand what's worked well there and see how we can make the same happen elsewhere. And the big thing that's worked well is that they have managed to work with the grain of technological change, allow jobs to change, allow older industries to go away, but create a lot of new and fairly productive jobs to replace them. So you have a high level of productivity across the population in the Nordic countries, more than in most other countries, where you see a sort of large fringe, a large tail of the working population being stuck in very low productive jobs. And that's really the main message here. We need to try to have almost an equality of productivity, if you like. We need to ensure that as many as possible, everyone ideally, can play a productive role in the economy, because then they will be paid well, and then there's less need for redistribution and fixing the problem that the market throws up.
And to do that, amongst other things, you do support the idea of a universal basic income, not as an anti-poverty measure, but as a means of giving more power to individual employees at the lower end of the wage scale, so that they can take time perhaps to retrain, so that they can be flexible and move jobs. But as you referenced earlier, with the decline of the trade union movement and collective bargaining across much of Western Europe and the United States, isn't it going to be difficult to get individual workers to take those risks without collective power behind them? And isn't it going to take a long time to educate them at an individual level?
Well, I think the word you mentioned, risk, is a key word here. Who bears the risk today? And one thing we've seen over the last couple of decades is that risk has shifted onto the shoulders of individual workers. That's partly because of the decline of unionism, it's partly because of policy changes, it's partly because of the way the labour market has changed, where there is now increasing amounts of work in kind of gig or irregular form rather than permanent employment. Now, some of that is good. It makes for flexibility in the economy. It means that people can shift their efforts more frequently, and they can adapt their working life to the rest of their lives, ideally. But of course, all the risk ends up on the individual. And what you see in many countries is a growth of this, it's a bit of a fancy term, but the precariat, people who live and work in extremely precarious situations with no savings, no liquid money in the case of an emergency, and importantly, no ability to shift into better jobs, because you need that kind of safety net to be able to say no to one job, take the time to find a new one, take the time to retrain, have the ability to say no to abusive demands from an employer, to say no to bad shift patterns, for example. So universal basic income is one of the ingredients I put in here. It's something that can allow an individual to say, actually, I will say no to this. If my employer demands that I work unpredictable shifts that can be cancelled the same morning, or things that are completely incompatible with taking care of my children, or if I just want to, you know, take that 1 month course to get a small qualification that allows me to apply for something else, a universal basic income will give you that, right? You won't be trapped in a bad job anymore. But there are many other things, right? So, you know, I propose aggressive minimum wage policies, for example, to create incentives for employers to use their labor more productively instead of relying on very cheap but very unproductive labor.
You also, I suppose, an issue that's sensitive in Ireland in particular, you also propose that we do tax multinationals more effectively across the globe, and you propose a net wealth tax, that the proceeds of which would be used, amongst other things, to try to give more empowerment and independence to those at the marginal end of things.
Yeah, taxes are one example of where policies seem to have gone kind of in the opposite direction from what you would expect given these big technological changes. So you've seen in most economies that there's an increasing share of the national income goes to those who either own or manage capital, the managerial class or capital owners. The kind of natural expectation for a policy that wants to compensate that shift would be to shift taxation also towards capital. But actually the opposite has happened, again, across OECD countries over the last 40 years. So I think it would be better if we reduce taxes on labor, or also spend on some of these policies that we mentioned before, and raise that money instead from taxes on capital, but smarter taxes than the ones we have now, because the way capital is taxed today actually doesn't encourage the most productive use of capital. So a net wealth tax, that means, you know, a percentage of everybody's net wealth, total assets minus their debts, recurrently every year. That actually is what I think of as a capitalist, pro-capitalist tax, because today we tax capital income, dividends, interest. We tax more the more successful a capitalist is, right? It's proportional to the return. A net wealth tax is proportional to the total wealth, which means that those who use their capital idly or unproductively, invest in luxury items or whatever, will actually pay a larger share of their returns in tax than those who are successful entrepreneurs. So it's a different way of taxing capital that I think can also encourage productivity. And the same is true for fixing international corporate taxation. Ireland, of course, the Irish state is a beneficiary from corporations organizing themselves to be tax liable in Ireland, or sometimes just using, in the past, using Irish legislation and loopholes to not pay tax anywhere. But so there is, of course, a challenge for the Irish budget, depending on how much depends on that. But in the bigger picture, what that means is that you have multinational corporations arranging themselves to pay less tax than corporations within single countries. But that's actually an unlevel playing field, right? Your local bookshop, your local taxi driver cannot arrange their tax affairs in the way that Amazon can or Uber can. So you're actually distorting the market here. And I think we'll get better productivity outcomes if everyone's treated equally. So if you want Amazon and Uber to pay the same tax on their activities as your local bookshop or your local taxi company, or talk about Airbnb and the local hotel, right? Then you actually do need to fix these loopholes. And that will be good for Irish businesses too, I think. So you do that by, you know, accounting for profits where economic activity happens, you know, get away from the old, postal address approach to where you pay tax. There is work happening on this. Now, Ireland, I think it will basically have to follow where the big powers decide to go. But I think at the moment they're going in the right direction.
Yeah, I agree, but not everybody here might. You also argue that governments need to actively, proactively support the cities, towns and regions that have been left behind, that are no longer feel they belong, as you put it. But we can't financially support every left behind city and town. You know, we can provide the broadband, we can connect up the roads and motorways, although that may cause more people to leave, as you write. But we can't put a research centre or an educational establishment in every left behind town and city. And in a free society, we can't force those who might work in those institutions to live in places they don't feel are attractive.
No, that's quite right. This is the toughest nut of all to crack, but also the most important to try to address. Regional inequality and increasing regional inequality, I think, is what has been the most corrosive of national politics and sort of a national community in one country after another. You see it with Brexit, you see it with Trump, you see it with the yellow vests in France. All of this can be traced back to rising regional disparities. It's a very difficult problem because it's driven by the change in the economy, where the leading sectors today tend to congregate in big cities because that's where they work best. That doesn't mean we're powerless. You're right, we can't hope to make every little place a center for cutting edge research, but we can do a lot more than today. And you actually sort of hinted at it in your question. There's the infrastructure. It's not just about pouring money into places. You know, you do need to sustain income so that you have local demand and local purchasing power and sufficient local living standards. But really what you want is for some of the cutting edge jobs and activities to themselves find other places attractive. So there won't be every little town or village, but it can be done more than just in the biggest ones. And so if you can create a critical mass of modern knowledge jobs in at least more places than now, that will at least help. Now, how do you do that? I mean, you said they have to be attractive. Exactly. You have to turn places into the sort of places where the people who get the best jobs would quite like to live, raise a family, and so on. And there's one little sort of anecdote I mention in the book. They've done focus groups in Britain, in some of these left behind towns, sort of very Brexity towns and small places. What is it you really want, right, to make things better? And one thing that consistently comes up high is, you know, we would like a nice high street with the sort of amenities that people have in richer places. That's the sort of thing. Places have to be livable and attractive to live in. So you need to move some of the jobs there if you can. Research institutions are a way to create that critical mass of modern jobs and make sure that, that there's enough local demand, local purchasing power, and these sort of level playing fields we talked about, right? So the local economy isn't hollowed out by big multinational corporations, so that people say, hey, this is an attractive place to live. And, you know, this can be done. There are places that have done it. There are countries that manage to spread the wealth better than others. But you have to start by really having that as the ambition and putting together the policies to make it happen.
You argue that your analysis and your proposed solutions are neither of the left nor the right in ideological terms, but right down the middle, liberal centrist, Western democracy, I suppose. Let's go back to where you start, though, the 1930s and what happened there, the divergence between the radical but democratic proposals that Roosevelt initiated and the horror of what autocrats like Hitler did. Do you think, COVID notwithstanding, that there is a sufficient feeling of urgency and emergency as there was in the 1930s for urgent action to be taken by democratic governments on this issue of the people in their states who don't feel belong?
Well, as we said earlier on, among much of the policymaking class, there hasn't been, right? There was this learned helplessness, this is the best we can do. I mean, one reason why I wrote the book was to try to push that process along, to create more sense of both urgency and actually possibility and opportunity. I think COVID is pushing this in the right direction. I think many more people have become aware of the precariousness of a big part of the population. We have seen in country after country how people on whose work we literally depend on for our lives, and I'm not just talking about doctors and nurses, but you know, nursing home carers, delivery drivers, supermarket shelf stockers, and so on, that a lot of these people really don't have very good jobs. I think there's more alertness to that. And at the same time, all these, you know, learnedly helpless politicians have become accidental radicals. They've locked down economies. That's a radical thing to do. They've poured money into income support schemes. Again, a radical thing to do. We've been forced in just a few months to do a lot more than we ever thought was conceivable. So we've opened up a political space here, and we're starting to get these debates about building back better. So I think we have a window of opportunity now where not only is there an appetite for big radical solutions, but there's a willingness among policy makers also in the center, not just on the fringes, to dare to think big. Now, that window won't be there forever, and I do hope that we make use of it. But because of how fragile and brittle our societies have become, I don't think it's a choice between radicalism and no radicalism. It's about what sort of radicalism we get and whether it serves to benefit everyone or the extreme fringes.
And can it be done on a state-by-state basis, or does it need to be done across groups of states, or else capital will differentiate in terms of how it's taxed or treated and move to where it sees it's a more benign environment for them?
Look, it's always great to have multilateral collaboration, and certainly the EU is set up to do things together, especially. But I actually think national policymakers retain a lot more control, a lot more power than they've often let on or even believed themselves. So in the case of taxing capital, I make some proposals for this, that there are ways of designing capital regulation and taxation in a way that allows you to do some of these things, even at a national level, if other countries don't do it. It's more challenging if you're the only one, but I don't think it's as challenging as many people think. It's certainly not a sort of fatal problem that you're the only country doing it. So I don't think that should be an excuse for inaction. It's much better for a country to go ahead. Let me give you one example, again, about multinational taxation. You know, for ages we've known that there was a problem. And it really started moving when a couple of countries, in particular France, said, actually, we're just going to do this on our own. Okay, we have tax treaties that mean we can't tax the corporate profits of a corporation based elsewhere, but we can have a turnover tax. So let's just have a turnover tax on digital companies. That was possible, created a lot of political fuss, but it started this process of collaborating. So I think they aren't really opposed. It may well be that if a country, especially a bigger country, just goes ahead, it will force others to sit up and think about how they collaborate with that.
Okay, we'll leave it there. It's certainly a rallying cry for radical change. That's Martin Sanbu, European economics commentator with the Financial Times and author of The Economics of Belonging, A Radical Plan to Win Back the Left Behind and Achieve Prosperity for All. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to hear now from Mark Blythe. He's Professor of International Economics at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and co-author of Angrynomics. Mark, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
This book is structured in a very interesting way, Mark. It's a sort of a pleasant, very civilized Socratic conversation, a dialogue between yourself and your fellow author, the Dublin-born hedge fund manager Eric Lonergan. But the name of the book, Angrynomics, where does that come from?
It kind of encapsulates the conversation that's in the book. We stumbled upon the importance of anger through talking about it. The way that the book came about, which is very briefly, I think, gives some interesting background on this. We couldn't find time to sit down and write, so we recorded the book as a series of dialogues. And when we wrote it out as normal text, we read it back and it was horrible. It read like two rich white guys who knew it all telling the whole world what was wrong, and it was boring. So we put it back in the dialogue. And when we put it back in the dialogue, we noticed that we were talking about the anger all the time. We thought, well, everyone takes this anger as a commonplace. It's out there. The world's never been more angry. But what does anger actually tell us? So it was through doing it as a dialogue that we stumbled upon the centrality of anger to the book itself.
When you say anger, what do you mean? Do you mean what we have noticed in terms of populist politics over the last 5-10 years?
Yes, that's just one part of it. But if you think about it, just before COVID, the whole world was angry. In Chile, they were rioting over levels of inequality. In Tel Aviv, 10 years ago, the middle classes were banging on the streets about the cost of living. In Hong Kong, it's democracy protesters. In France, it's Gilets Jaunes protesters. The whole world has never been richer, but at the same time, we never seem to have so many variegated outpourings of anger. So it's trying to explain that phenomenon, why we've never been more rich as a planet, and at the same time, more upset about the distribution of those riches.
I think your co-author, Eric Lonergan, whom I said is a hedge fund manager, sees a whole range of reasons as to why this anger has come to the fore, even though at a nominal level, we're all better off than we were. You in particular, though, want to focus on one key issue, and that is inequality of wealth, inequality of income and inequality of wealth.
Yes. So I think this has been a long time coming. If you go back to basically the 1970s, the way we try and explain this in the book is to use an analogy of capitalism as basically a computer. It's composed of different bits of hardware, which are labor markets, capital markets, that sort of stuff. And then software, which are the ideas and rules that we have for governing a system. And just like a computer, if you keep overloading the software and the hardware has faults, eventually you get a system crash, and that's when you get large outpourings of anger. The last big one in the 70s, the crisis of inflation, led to a fundamental reset of the software, the ideas, but also the hardware in the form of independent central banks and globalization and liberalization of markets, etc. And that created a huge dispersal between those who have assets and those who do not, those who rely on wages and those who have wealth income. And that has been the defining trend of this past 30 years. Now, in 2008, there was a credit crisis. In a sense, that system failed, and there should have been a reset at that point. But what we argue is the central banks come in and basically bail out the system. None of the underlying problems of those inequalities are addressed. And essentially, by pushing down on the volatility, eventually you're going to see this coming back up, and that's what you see in the rise of both left-wing and right-wing populist politics.
To what degree? Because we have seen cycles of anger in previous generations, and that anger that took to the streets in very violent ways, whether it was the winter of discontent in the UK in the 70s, huge mass demonstrations here in Ireland about the tax system in the late 70s and 80s, left and right-wing terrorism directed at state, both the state and wealthy individuals across the European continent in the 70s. But do you think this long pent up anger about perceived inequality or actual inequality now comes because we as a population generally are much more aware of it through media, through social media, all of that? We're aware of how others look as if they're doing much better than us.
Absolutely. And the other side of that is how media basically allows politicians to weaponize these inequalities for good or for ill. But let's stick with an Irish example. By all metrics on average, Ireland's been doing great for the past 3 years. And you basically threw out the government that was doing it. Why were you doing this? In part because you have the phenomenon of a middle-class housing and homelessness crisis in Ireland because of the price of a particular asset class, which is housing. And these are the types of things which really drive people to despair, because you could be working and have two kids and you can't afford to put food on the table because housing's so damn expensive. Because right across the world, we stopped building public housing in 1980 and we effectively turned it into an asset class for the top 20% of the population. That's something that people are extremely aware of, and it's something that they're quite rightly outraged about.
Now, people who come to the book, people who read it, will be glad that you propose some very interesting solutions, as well as painting a picture of where we've got to, Mark. And you have three pretty simple underlying tenets that are the framework of those solutions.
Yeah, so the first one is basically, is it simple? Right? Can you tell someone what it is and why it should work? The second one is, it should last more than one parliamentary session. So is this something that's going to get support across the left and the right? And the third one, is it effective, right? To use that great British phrase, does it do what it says on the tin? So we basically thought about that, and I'd extend it now if I had a chance to twiddle with the book a little bit. I like to think of these things not as policies, but as furniture. And here's what I mean by this. When you rearrange the furniture in a room, you rearrange the conversations that people can have, the type of environment that they're working in. So we don't think of these as policies. We think of them as things that if you put them in the political room and everyone gets used to them, it changes the very nature of our political discussions and it changes the way our economy works. So that's why we concentrate on these three large things at the end of the book.
I suppose the most radical solution or proposal that you put out there is that governments should avail of the current era of historically low interest rates to proactively get involved in the markets to hopefully make money out of doing so, and we'll come back to that perhaps, and then to redistribute that surplus that they make to try to address inequality in their societies.
Absolutely. A citizens' wealth fund is what we call for. David McWilliams has actually been making the case that Ireland should be a country that does this, and we wholeheartedly agree. So let's think about this. The Federal Reserve here in the United States basically said to everyone who has financial assets, don't worry, lads, we've got your back. Well, to use the language of the street, we will catch every falling knife that goes out there. You got ETFs that are losing value, we'll buy them. You got corporate debt that's just going to go crappy, no problem, we'll buy it. We'll even pretend it's good debt when it's bad debt. And what that basically signals is the relevant constituency that governments care about are people who have assets. And there's no limit to how much money there is for them. On the other hand, what do they do for American workers? You're unemployed, mate. Good luck filing for unemployment. And here's a check. You might get one, you might not. So it's quite clear the way that the distribution on this thing works. Now, why on earth do we allow this to happen? Whenever you have a financial crisis, investors dump equities and want to buy safe assets. So safe assets are bonds. We can issue them at a negative real rate. They're paying us to buy the bonds. The auctions never fail. Why not issue an extra 20% of GDP, buy all those equities up and put them in a completely passive public fund, and then we get the upside of those things coming back, which usually works out to a 6% real compounded over 10 to 15 years. If you do that, you could pay back the debt and still have 20% of GDP or 15% of GDP to distribute to the bottom 80% of the income distribution so that they actually have a stake in national wealth and national income. This doesn't involve raising taxes. This doesn't involve creating any risk on balance sheet, because net on net, the government's balance sheet's buying real assets. It's simply an asset for cash swap, right? And it's far better than basically saying to corporations, don't worry, lads, you're the insiders. We've got your back. Everybody else can just deal with it.
Before we get into the risks involved in such a scenario, Mark, and I think there would be risks involved, who would actually, the idea would be that we would borrow at historically low interest rates, zero or just above zero interest rates, to invest in the stock market, basically.
Yeah.
Who would manage that investment program? Because once politicians are tied into it anyway, the temptation will be there, or the pressure will be there to dip into it every now and again and to use it for other purposes.
Now, other countries have managed to do this quite successfully. It's all in how you design it. Essentially, you just set it up as a giant passive fund that owns a small percentage of the widest possible distribution, and you run it as a passive fund. You don't allow politicians to go anywhere near it. It requires one founding act of parliament, and the rules clearly states that you cannot dip into this. There's an independent board. They're elected for long terms that are not synchronized to the electoral cycle. You can easily do this. It's just a question of design.
Which countries have actually done this successfully, other than those like particularly smaller states, other than the likes of Norway, who have pumped vast sources of wealth from their oil reserves?
Yes, whereas the Brits took it and used it to finance tax cuts and unemployment in the 1980s. So it shows you the difference in what can happen. Norway is per capita the richest country in the world because of this. But there's also Singapore has done this. There's a whole bunch of other sovereign wealth funds. Russia does it with its oil money. It's non-discriminatory. You've got authoritarian regimes that do it, democratic regimes that do it. But ours is different in the sense that we don't just want this as a passive vehicle that somehow is held as a pile of cash or equities for the nation so that the government, whoever that is, runs it. There's a clear mandate. This is wealth generated for the citizenry. They have assets. This is their assets, and they should be able to take the resulting upside from that.
But isn't the difference in this case, other than as distinct from what Norway and Russia have done, is that what you're arguing is that countries like Ireland and larger countries too don't take existing wealth, whatever its source, but borrow from the markets to invest in equities. And the risk, yes, the risk there is that at some stage, and it has happened in the past, that no matter how bullish the stock market has been, equities will turn down and could turn down quite quickly. There is still a debit side of the ledger whereby the borrowings have to be paid back.
Well, there is and there isn't, because essentially, yes, it's absolutely true that equity markets dip. But if you look at the number of times they dip relative to the number of times they don't, then that dip is simply another opportunity to issue more debt and buy it. Because the long-term trend on equities right across the world, even when you factor in those dips, is basically 4 to 6% real averaged over 20 years. So there is no risk. Second one is, we're not borrowing at low rates. We're borrowing at negative real rates. And no bond auction in recent memory of any sovereign with an A rating has failed. No one's forcing people to buy this debt. Ireland could, if it had its own printing press, which, you know, it can't. But if Ireland was completely monetarily sovereign, it could just walk up to the markets tomorrow, given Ireland's economic profile, and issue 30% of debt, and basically your gilt market or equivalent wouldn't move. The Brits have just proven this with the way that they handled the COVID crisis. They basically said 30% of GDP, right, lads, throw that on the balance sheet, and the gilt market barely budged. So we live in a very different world.
I still think that the government in power, when equity markets might crash, and particularly given that a lot of their private citizens might be invested in equity markets through their pensions as well, could see a lot more populist anger on the streets than if you did nothing. But I take it that we need radical ideas here. Another one you have, and perhaps simpler to execute, is a data dividend from the large tech companies. Tell us how you propose that would work.
So the United States told the OECD to go stuff itself because it wanted to tax the American digital multinationals. Amazon, Google, Apple, et cetera. And they basically said, no, you don't get to do that. And if you try it, we're going to put tariffs on you. So here's another way of doing this. What we forget is that the profit engines for those companies is our data. We put the inputs through our keyboards, through our videos, everything into them, and they monetize that. In a sense, that is our property rights. What's more capitalist than making a property rights claim to your own data? If these were mobile phone companies, we would sell them bits of the spectrum for 15 years for X billion, and then we'd renegotiate the deal. As it is, we just give it up for free because Facebook gives it for free. But it's a con. The only way it works is because they have a claim on property rights and we don't get anything back for them. So all I'm saying is we should monetize our property rights, sell them the data, license the data, and that way you can tax them without it actually being a tax.
And are you arguing that governments should do this on behalf of their citizens?
Absolutely. Or alternatively, you can empower the third sector, the NGO sector, to do this. There's plenty of expertise across that sector for setting up the type of institutions where you could have third-party servers that would host the data. You could give people opt-in or opt-out so that they could be completely in it or not in it. There's many ways to handle this.
I think we're all agreed, or most of us are agreed, that we need a more effective taxation system for many of these multinational tech companies that are using our data in this way. But my daughter's generation would argue that they know full well that their data is being used, and that's the quid pro quo, that they get free or very convenient services in return for that data. So why will the digital companies pay up as well?
Because if they don't pay up, we stop giving them the data. You can simply block them as a platform. Why wouldn't we do this?
We're not China, Mark.
Why not? At the end of the day, if you're making a property rights claim that you should do this and they refuse to play ball, it's simple regulatory politics. If a company comes into Ireland and says, hey, we don't like your environmental standards, we're going to start polluting, you wouldn't allow the company to operate. Why is that any different?
It could get a lot of citizens' backs up that it's down to their individual choice.
It certainly can, and that's what they rely on. But if we don't do this eventually, we're basically creating a world in which 20% of the US stock market is driven by five or six companies. They pay no taxes. They do no innovation. They employ hardly any people. They buy up companies that are innovating to protect their market position. They don't pay taxes. Why would we be part of that? That's actually the death of innovation.
Would you agree that the analysis you put forward and the solutions you proposed, and as you say, simple, make them effective and across party lines, would you agree that they will appear radical to many people who will read this, but they're not revolutionary? What you're effectively arguing is that the existing economic financial system should be used by governments to use in its current state almost to generate wealth and redistribute it in a different way.
Absolutely. You'll notice that none of these proposals actually say, let's raise taxes. Right? So we're just using the furniture in a different way and building new furniture, in a sense, to put in the room. So I think it's very sort of friendly to both left and right in that regard. Is it radical? We don't even think it's that radical. As you say, it's more about focusing on what you've got and using it better. One way to think about this was, I'm a child of the Thatcher years. And say what you like about Mrs. Thatcher and people like her in that period, they were what they called conviction politicians. They had ideas, they followed through on them, and that was the deal, that you knew what you're getting. The current crop of politicians governed by polls which are tested every 36 hours. And if something comes up and the public doesn't like it, it gets dropped whether it's a good idea or not. We don't lack ideas now, we lack politicians with conviction and courage. And I think that's the major weakness that we see across the world.
And these redistribution proposals whereby wealth or income generated by the states through existing market mechanisms would be redistributed to people at the lower end of the income spectrum or the wealth spectrum, that would be used to develop their human capital by and large through education programs or health programs, the likes of which? Or would you be an advocate of what's loosely called helicopter money, just give them the cash?
It depends on the situation. If you're in a recession, I think we should absolutely do helicopters. And in effect, that's what the United Kingdom is doing. But I would leave it to countries themselves to decide in the scale they want to operate at what they would do with their national wealth fund. Ireland is a rich and successful country because of the quality of its human capital. It would make perfect sense to deploy that to augment our human capital. But you know what else would make a big difference in the lives of Irish people, Irish workers? Housing. Using it to build high-quality public housing, which is then basically public assets on the balance sheet of the state, which counts as a net positive against any debt they issue. So there's lots of things that we could do with this, but I would leave it to the individual countries to decide what they do. In a sense, it's a bit like striking North Sea oil, only this time we're not going to waste it.
It's a fascinating and provocative book, but we leave it there. That's thanks to Mark Blythe, the William R. Rose Professor of International Economics at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University and co-author of Angrynomics. Mark, thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success. through innovative training and upskilling.